This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, Chinese blogger, and goes to Jimmy John's for the free smells. My co-host is John Pasden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and heard there are hot singles in your area. In this episode, John and I talk about the connection between culture and language. Just how important is a grasp of the culture to learn Chinese? In addition to a rant and a rave, we've got a new segment about our adventures in China. Guest interview is with Imran Alston. In addition to being an accomplished Chinese learner, he has developed software to assist Chinese learners and is an admin on the popular website Chinese-forums.com. He shares with us insights gained from years of interacting with Chinese learners. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner.
Hey, I'm John Pasden in Shanghai, China.
Oh, so you're in Shanghai? So you think you're better than me, John?
More Chinese, apparently.
Evidently. All right, let's kick off this episode. Hey, before we get going, though, we have some reviews. John, you got a review for us?
Yeah, so this is a 5-star review saying, great podcast. This is such a great podcast. I'm studying Chinese and I'm now living in Xiamen, got here in August. This is now my safe place during my commute time. It's such a motivational podcast for those learning Chinese. I enjoy the fact that it has so many different people sharing their experiences. Congratulations. And that's from Rafael Lemos via Apple in Great Britain. Thank you.
All right. And we have another review. This is another 5-star review. And he says, this podcast changed my performance. The Chinese language program at my school was shutting down due to budget cuts. And I was at the Chinese 2 level. And if I only took Chinese 3 class, I would not be able to take the AP Chinese test the next year. So I took both, and I was struggling to learn 70 words a week and multiple passages. I was using pinyin as a crutch in AP Chinese because I did not have the Chinese 3 class in the beginning for a foundation. But this podcast helped me through writing the words without dying of boredom. Thank you for helping me get 106% in my AP Chinese class. And that's Super T Polar here in the United States. And hey, that's awesome, man.
Wow, that is amazing.
I love hearing stories like that.
Does that mean he took Chinese 3 and Chinese 4 at the same time? I can't imagine a school even letting you do that.
It appears so. But I don't know. There's a dedicated. I'd assume that we gave some sort of motivation to this guy.
Yeah, glad we could help. Okay, today we're talking about how important is it to understand culture to learn a language? I think this is something you hear all the time. Oh, culture is so important. But what does it really mean and how true is it?
Yeah, and this is something I even talked about last podcast when we had Diane on the show. I remember this story my brother had told me where he had this German class and the teacher was so insistent, you got to understand culture in order to speak German. And I kind of had a different perspective on it. But John, what is your view on this?
Well, I have to say, I went into it without worrying about culture too much. I studied Chinese for a little bit before going to China, and my view was, I'll learn the culture along the way. I'm not too worried about it. I definitely was not like super focused on culture, like this is the key to unlocking everything. I was just kind of, you know, doing my thing, learning as I went.
My general perspective is that, no, you don't need to understand the culture in order to speak the language. Now, I speak about this on a very, I guess, basic level. If you go to China or, gosh, anywhere that's speaking Chinese and try to speak in Chinese, you don't really need to have a cultural grasp of the language in order to say, "我要这个," you know, I want this, or I want to go here, or I'm interested in this, or I like that. This is kind of my perspective that you don't need to have a lot of cultural context in order to do a lot of this basic communication in language. However, if you are now in a different context where you're approaching more intermediate levels and you're trying to have conversations, sometimes now culture becomes much more important to the nuances of your communication.
Yeah, so at some point you want to move from just being able to say the words that make sense in Chinese minds and to decode the responses to actually communicating with people in a natural way. To give a very simple example that all beginners would understand. Like, you move to China, you start interacting with people on a daily basis. Like, every time you leave your apartment complex, you say hi to the guard there at the gate, right? And he's like, "Nichifalama," right? And you learn early on that that means, have you eaten? And you learn from your Chinese One textbook, oh, that's the way that Chinese people greet each other. But I remember for the longest time, I was just like, that is so weird. Do I have to tell him if I ate or not? Or like, what if I lie? Or like, what if I ask him and he doesn't reply? Or like, what if I ask him and he starts talking about meals and I don't know what he's saying? Like, I was having all these thoughts about it. But if you just look at it from a cultural perspective, like, this is just something you say when you greet someone. You say hi, but you don't say hi. You say this. It also leads you down this road of like how extremely important Chinese food is in Chinese culture. And it kind of has this domino effect. You start here and it starts unlocking other things which help make more conversations and more interactions make more sense.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about language in general, like, why do we have language? And the purpose of it, it's a tool to communicate. And if we are communicating just only from our own, per se, our own cultural reference, we're going to miss out on a whole lot. I always like this example when I used to live in England for a couple of years. And in England, usually, at least in where I was, how you greet someone, you say, all right. So it's like, you know, are you all right? And in America, we're kind of always like, hey, what's up? But the difference between this is that in England, it's like you say, all right. And in America, if someone says, are you all right? It's kind of like, yeah, I'm fine. Well, why? What's the matter? You know, but in England, if you say, what's up? It's kind of like, hey, man, what's up? What's going on? What did you do? And so you have this awkward exchange because you're communicating using your own cultural reference. Someone says to me, all right. And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. What's up? And they're like, oh, nothing. Gee. So it's just kind of this awkward standoff. And so if you don't understand the cultural aspects, I think, of some of the language, you're going to have some of these awkward exchanges. And I think something that I struggled with early on when I was learning Chinese and I was in China is I wanted to say things in an American way. An English way. You know, I wanted to say proverbially, like, what's up? And you can't translate that over. And only way to fully understand, like, how someone greets each other or how you more casually say hello to someone is begin to understand it from their personal cultural reference.
Right. So speaking of that personal cultural reference, let's get into that food thing a little more, because I think this one is ripe for a cultural misunderstanding or, you know, understanding.
Ripe.
So like, Chinese people will typically praise your Chinese. Even if it's not amazing, they will say it is. You shouldn't be annoyed by that. If you know your Chinese is bad, you should just be gracious and accept that it's a part of their culture, that they're going to praise your Chinese no matter how bad it is, or possibly directly proportionally to how bad it is. In the same way, when they ask you if you like Chinese food, oh man, have you ever seen someone tell Chinese people that they don't like Chinese food?
Yeah.
That doesn't go over well. In the same way, I've had so many conversations with Chinese people, like trying to, it's like the typical internet, like someone is wrong on the internet, you got to prove them wrong. But like with Chinese food, it's like, all right, guys, Chinese people, Chinese food is good. Yes. But other countries have good food too. Can we acknowledge that other countries have good food? Like, why is it that when foreigners come to China, they like the food, but when they go to other countries, they also like the food? Whereas when Chinese people go abroad, they have trouble liking the food in a lot of places. It's like, maybe someone's right and someone's wrong here. No, that doesn't work. So you just gotta fall in line culturally if you want to have any kind of smooth exchanges. I mean, if you love having debates about the superiority of cuisine that are never going to be won, well, this is a good country to come to and get fluent in Chinese so that you can engage in that particular hobby. But I've seen a couple of my friends that speak very good Chinese. They've gotten very into the food. You know, like when a friend makes some food for them, they just flip out and, you know, they love it. When a friend takes them to a restaurant, they're super enthusiastic. They're enthusiastic about trying different kinds of Chinese food, even some of the ones that some of the more squeamish of us might not like. And man, Chinese people love these people. Like, they make friends so easily. I bet Jared, you're kind of like this, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I'll eat anything. I remember, God, I've eaten some crazy things, and sometimes people are like, oh, do you know what you're eating? I'm like, no. I remember one time I was sitting around, it was a business dinner, sitting around the table, and I was eating something out of this pot, and I'm like, this is really good. It was really soft and moist and tender. and it had some bones in it. And I'm like, what is this? And they're like, it's bullfrog. And I'm like, oh, I guess I like bullfrog. And everyone was like, hey, look at this foreigner guy. He loves bullfrog.
I like it, too. It's pretty good.
It is good. So being able to have a little bit better of a cultural understanding is going to enrich your conversation. To me, something that I found fascinating is when I found connections between the Chinese language and the culture. Now, one thing that China sometimes has a reputation for is, you know, memorizing, just learning knowledge, and they're very good at maybe learning strings of numbers and just memorizing facts. One of the reasons I believe that this is because that's a function of the Chinese language, because there are so many Chinese characters that you have to learn. There is no other way to learn these other than rote memorization. In fact, the first 5 years of the primary education in China is so focused on acquiring these characters. And even when the kids are moving into junior high, they're continually practicing characters. Their teachers will quiz them on writing characters. And the Chinese are very good at this. They've been practicing this and developing educational methods for learning characters for centuries, frankly. And I've seen it with my own kids. And John, I'm sure you have too.
Yeah.
So this is one of the things that I found, that the language has influenced the culture. And it didn't really click to me till I got deeper into things and seen, oh, this is one thing, how the language is interwoven with the culture.
Well, strictly speaking, the writing system is a technology that's been kind of incorporated into the language. It's not really the language itself at the core, but yeah, I know what you're saying. Especially if you're Chinese, you do see it that way as one thing. I've noticed that when you talk to Chinese people about learning Chinese, if you bring up how, you know, you find it kind of hard to memorize a lot of characters, you get a lot of sympathy for that because they went through quite a bit of that as children and they still forget characters as adults.
That's so true. Character amnesia, it's a very real thing. Side note, if you forget how to write characters that you once knew how to write, you're not alone. Chinese people experience that too.
Especially Chinese people living abroad.
Hey, I once had my Ai forgot how to write Putuo district, and she couldn't remember how to write the Tuo, and I don't know, for some reason I remembered it. So, hey, it even happened in China to me once.
So, one other place I think that culture plays a big role, you know, when learning a language is humor. I think, Jared, you've had quite a bit of experience with this, as have I. Like, once you get your Chinese to a certain level where you can string a sentence together and express what you want, you think that you can make a joke because, like, oh yeah, this joke is just lining up these words and it'll be funny, and it's totally not funny. So I can't give you a step-by-step guide on how to learn to be funny in Chinese, but I can tell you it takes a long time. I think both Jared and I have had many jokes fall flat in Chinese. Like, I'm fairly good at humor now, but I can't even put into words exactly how I did it.
It's just one of those things, you get the feel of the language, right? And you can understand your audience. I mean, just think about it in English. You tell a joke in English doesn't mean you're going to get a laugh. Even if it was a great joke by some comedian, your delivery's wrong or you didn't quite understand it well enough to emphasize it in the right way.
Yeah, I think one way that is really easy to start adapting your style of humor, especially for Americans, is to just stop being sarcastic, because those little sarcastic comments will always be misinterpreted as a sincere comment. And that's just not funny.
As I think about it, there's not a lot of sarcasm in Chinese.
Yeah, it's rare. Like, my wife is hilarious and she's sometimes sarcastic.
She is.
It's, you know, one of the reasons I love her.
She cracks me up.
Yeah, but most people are not sarcastic when they speak Chinese.
So there you go. That's one cultural thing I think is important to understand. There's not a lot of sarcasm. So going back to what I had said at the beginning, no, I do not think that you need to understand the culture in order to use Chinese or to learn Chinese. However, and this is the big caveat, by learning Chinese, it provides to you a conduit into the Chinese culture. And by learning that language, it's going to allow you to connect and communicate with people from a different culture. And it's going to open up a whole new expanse to you in depth that you didn't understand otherwise. And you can't understand otherwise. And I do believe that there are certain things and aspects of the Chinese culture that you cannot understand if you do not learn the language. And but by learning the language, it's kind of like that key that unlocks some of the mysteries to you. And to me, it's enriching. It expands your cultural view, your worldview. And I even put the term sometimes, you know, like the brotherhood of man, right? You just kind of understand these commonalities between people, and then they have their emotions and feelings and how they look at the world in different ways. And to me, it's an enriching experience.
Yeah, for sure. And I think for beginners, especially if you're not in China, you know, you're studying in your home country, it is good to learn about the culture, and hopefully it's interesting to you, but it's not super high priority, like to really get the cultural differences. So you don't need to stress about it. Learn it as much as it interests you. And just keep in mind that once you're interacting on the ground, in the wild, speaking Chinese, it's going to become more and more important. But it's all those little cultural faux pas that you're going to commit, which help you really learn it.
All right, we have a word from our sponsor. And our sponsor today is Mandarin Companion.
That's a good company.
So I've heard. All right, John, today we are talking about The 60-Year Dream. And the reason I bring this up, because this book is packed with cultural elements.
Right, so it's based on Rip Van Winkle. This is one of the books that we were not able to somehow make the English title work in Chinese. So the title in Chinese became the title in English, The 60-Year Dream. Rip Van Winkle supposedly slept for like, was it 100 years?
Like 50 years or something.
Okay, so we made the stretch of time that he slept for conveniently skip from pre-communist China to basically modern China, because it creates a huge discrepancy in the society.
And in that book, there's a lot of things which pique your interest about Chinese culture, and especially the change that happened in Chinese, just massive change that happened in that country within a relatively short period of history. So it's a level one book. It's written only using 300 basic characters. So you can go out and get it today.
Enjoy.
Okay, we have a new segment that we're going to put on this show. I don't know how often we'll do this, but we're going to try it. So, John, you tell them what this is, and I'll start it.
So it's called Two Truths and a Lie, and we're going to focus on life in China, right?
Yes.
Okay, so Jared, he's going to be the one giving us the three statements, and I'm going to do my best to figure out which one is the lie.
Okay, you ready? Here we go. First one. One time, I used bobby pins to pick a lock on a door to the roof so we could go rooftopping on a building.
All right.
Two. One time, a guy came to repair our washing machine. He ended up frying the circuitry, and we had to replace the whole thing.
Okay.
Three. One time, I broke up a fight between a taxi driver and a guy on a scooter that was holding up hundreds of people in the middle of the street. All right, John, which one is it?
All right, I know the third one is true because you posted it to Facebook.
Dang you.
All right, so that one was easy. Yes, Jared is a brave man. He jumps into fights. That was right by your cinnamon roll shop, right?
You're not supposed to remember this whole story.
Okay.
It's a good story, though.
I'll skip to the other two. So bobby pins to open a lock to get onto the roof.
Yeah, I used bobby pins. I was of a friend's hair, had bobby pins in it, and I used those and I picked a lock.
Yeah, that sounds like a lie to me. Number two, about frying the circuitry, sounds very possible. It's not just a matter of like the skill of the workers. It's also like a lot of these buildings have really old circuitry. It needs to be replaced anyway. So it's just waiting for someone to, do anything to fry it. So I think that's very plausible. And the lie is number one.
All right, John, you ready?
Yep.
The lie is the washing machine.
Oh.
But I know what you're saying. I think I know someone who that's actually happened to, but it didn't happen to me. But I did actually use bobby pins. We were out on like a double date and we wanted to go rooftopping, and we had this little rickety lock on a door, and I was like, hey, let me see the bobby pins. I might be able to pick the lock. And I did. And it was like so exciting. We couldn't be like yell because there were apartments close by and we didn't want people to hear us. So we were like, oh, I just picked the lock. It was so cool. Anyway, and we got on the rooftop and did some awesome pictures.
Did some parkour building to building.
Pretty much. We base jumped off there.
All right, cool.
So next time, John, it's your turn.
All right, I was thinking about maybe doing one related to learning Chinese, but I have some time to think about it.
Okay, cool. All right, next segment is rants and raves. All right, John, what do you got for us? You got a rant or a rave?
I've got a rave. So I just took the whole family last night to go see a movie. It's the animated DreamWorks movie, Abominable, about the Yeti.
Oh, I saw that.
You see it?
I saw that last weekend. Yeah, it was fun.
It was really good. It was really interesting because it was set in China. We saw the English language version. It had subtitles. It was really good. I haven't really read up on it. like how well it did in the Chinese market, I get the sense that it didn't do great, even though it seems to be kind of tailor-made for the Chinese market. And I'm not sure how well it did in the American market, even though I know it got pretty decent reviews. But I just thought it was a really nice movie. Kids loved it. I think they said it was one of their new favorite movies. Personally, I don't think it's better than Into the Spider-Verse, but it was still really good.
I do have a rant about that movie.
Oh.
I mean, I love the movie. It was a lot of fun. It brought a lot of bad memories back about living in China and my kids, too. They're like, oh, yeah, I remember this and see that. But, you know, in the movie, they go around to popular areas in China, like they go to Yellow Mountain.
Yeah.
And Yellow Mountain is amazing, right? You've been there. And they're walking down the paths. But I'm like, there's no way on earth that is Yellow Mountain because there were no people there.
Right.
If it was real Yellow Mountain, I mean, the whole pass would just have been, shoulder to shoulder, like people just packed, moving, walking up and down around the mountain. And that's the reality of the situation.
Right. That is true. And I think if you plot their course on a map, it's not going to be a very clear path. And China's really big.
And they're traveling like hours between locations. I'm like, this is like, a full day train ride.
All right. So it's a kid's movie. They took some liberties with the logistics of the plot, but it was quite enjoyable.
It wasn't very enjoyable. I enjoyed it. So you go out there and see it. Abominable.
You're not going to learn a lot of Chinese, but... Oh, let me ask you this, Jared, because I was kind of surprised by this. There was one line of Chinese aside from the character names, and they call the grandma Nai Nai. The rock, paper, scissors. For some reason, that one line was in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
In the English version we saw. Was it like that in the States?
I don't remember, but I think it was in Chinese.
It was just strange that they made only that one line entirely in Chinese.
And that's an interesting point for our listeners, too, is that it's in Chinese, it's not rock, paper, scissors. It's
paper, scissors, rock. Oh, no, sorry.
No, it's not. It's not paper. It's cloth.
Rock, scissors, cloth. Yeah.
Yeah, that's rock, scissors, cloth. So, but it makes sense, right? Actually, I think cloth makes a little more sense than paper, right? Because paper, you sit on top of a rock, it's going to kind of, float off to the side. But cloth, it's going to cover that thing up.
Yeah, it's kind of weak, like only scissors can defeat paper, Cloth makes more sense. All right, so you have one too?
Okay, yes. I have got a rant. Now, this is a rant that can turn into a rave. For our learners, it's a tone mistake, it's a tone problem, and it's an easy problem to have. So this is when people say Meiguo or America. So a lot of times people, when they're learning Chinese like this, now Meiguo, it's a third tone followed by a second tone. And this is one of the hardest combinations of tones. And what people typically will end up saying, well, they'll say Meiguo, which is the first tone, then second tone. And I got to say, I did it and was all rant about it back then. This is one of the things my wife does it sometimes, and I'll say to them, like, it's Meiguo. She's like, Meiguo. I'm like, no, not Meiguo, Meiguo. But there's a good trick for this if you're having trouble with that third, second tone. A lot of times we want to do that third tone where we kind of start high, Mei. But when you want to do the third tone into the second tone, you don't even start high. You start low. It's like Meiguo. So you don't go Meiguo, you just go Meiguo. If you could hear that, that's something that will help you out. So if you guys can practice that, practice on your third, second tone, you can turn this rant into a rave and you can be out there saying it perfectly, Meiguo, every time.
All right, I'm going to have to agree and disagree on this one.
What?
I agree that 3-2 is the hardest tone pair. In fact, my master's thesis was on this very topic about the relative difficulty of tone pairs to foreigners. But... the saying first, second tones for Meiguo, I think only a beginner, an elementary person would make that mistake. What I hear a lot are what I call the 3-2 tone swap. I wrote a blog post on this. So a lot of times, especially intermediate learners, like you think you know the tones, but when you speak, you get them wrong. Instead of saying Meiguo, they'll say Meiguo. So they're saying second, third, Meiguo, that's wrong. When they should be saying Meiguo, third, second. But anyway, to your point, that 3-2 tone pair is rough, and Americans especially need to learn it.
There you go, John. You just enhanced my rant. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Amplified ire.
Amplified ire. That didn't even sound right. What did I do? Did I do the 2-3?
I don't know what you're doing.
I don't even know what I'm doing either. Let's just cut to the interview.
My name is Imran Alston, and I'm from Australia.
Our paths have crossed many times on ChineseForums.com, where he's one of the admins.
I'm a software developer by trade, but I guess I've been learning Chinese for nearly 20 years now.
One thing I've learned about Imran, he is full of surprises.
Something interesting about me that you might not know, I like to juggle. I can juggle five balls without too much difficulty. I also ride a unicycle sometimes.
Imran has interacted with thousands of Chinese learners, and he bestows upon us his well-earned wisdom gained over the years. This is an interview you won't want to miss. Stay with us. You're a Chinese-speaking, juggling, unicycle-riding software developer.
That's correct.
Right.
Only the software development earns me a living, though. The other things don't pay so well.
Unless you're in the circus, right? I juggle as well, but I can only do three, so I'm very impressed to know you can do five.
You know, people, you juggle five and people say, oh, wow, you must be so coordinated to do that. And it's like, well, I am now, but that's only after practicing, and then building it up, and then you get there. And it's exactly the same thing with Chinese. People look at it and say, oh, wow, you know, you know so many characters or know this and that, or you can read. And it's like, well, I can now, but it's only because of years and years of practice.
And Imran, we first got in contact through the ChineseForums.com. So you've been a longtime commentator on that on the forum. So I'm glad we really have to you on the show here.
A longtime admin as well. I've been adminning there for a long time.
Well, I'd like to hear your story on why did you start learning Chinese? How did this all start for you?
The earliest it probably started is an interest in Chinese movies, so particular Chinese martial arts movies, Jackie Chan. I still remember the first time I watched one of his movies. It was Rumble in the Bronx. My brother was like, oh, you've got to watch this movie. It's really funny.
I love that movie. That's a great show.
Yeah, it's a great movie. So, and that got me into then Jackie Chan and a whole lot of other, you know, the Chinese martial arts movies. So I developed an interest in that from there. After university, I was traveling around Europe and I ended up working in London for a while. And so I thought, well, next time I go somewhere, I'd like to go somewhere completely different, somewhere where I don't sort of have the language skill, somewhere I know nothing about, something completely different. And I was thinking, okay, well, maybe somewhere in Asia. Then I was thinking, okay, you know, because the style of Kung Fu that I learned was from Hong Kong. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll go and look into learning Cantonese or something like that. And so I was looking around for night schools in London where they had Chinese language, and I couldn't find any Cantonese courses, and they had Mandarin. And at the time, you know, I didn't really know much about the Chinese language at all. And I thought, oh, Cantonese, Mandarin, what's the difference? Obviously, there's a huge difference, but at the time, I didn't really know that. And I signed up for the Mandarin courses anyway. After a few months, on the notice board outside the classrooms, one day I saw an ad that was like, you know, go and teach English in China. And so I thought, oh, okay, that's maybe a good way to go and travel and live in the country and get exposure to the language through there. So I signed up for that. And that's sort of how it all began.
All right. So you got some Chinese classes under your belt, and then you said, hey, let's go to China.
Yep.
But first off, I want to hear a little bit, like, what was that Chinese class like? I mean, was it something engaging? It looks like something that made an impact on you. Why did you decide to continue to study?
It wasn't that engaging so much. I mean, it was funny because it started out there about, it's been ages ago now, so it's difficult to remember. I think there may be like maybe six or seven people in the class at the beginning, and then it slowly started to dwindle. It was just, you know, standard early Chinese stuff, you know, counting and saying hello, and I like to drink tea, and I like to do this, and so on. And
but you stuck with it. I mean, what was it about?
It gave me a little bit of a grounding in the language, so that when I could arrive, I could say, you know, hello and count to 10 and whatnot. But by the time I arrived in China, my language skills were still basically zero. I'd had about 6 or 7 months of language classes at that point, and that was just an hour once a week. So, you know, it still doesn't really prepare you for when you first arrive in China and you get off the plane and suddenly you're illiterate and you can't read and you can't communicate and you can't do anything.
Well, you know, something I'm kind of interested in hearing about here, it kind of relates to a question that I usually ask towards like the end of our conversation. It would be like, hey, if you could go back and do it over, what would you do differently? But a lot of times people, they're studying Chinese and they have that kind of experience that you said, hey, I studied for 6 months and it sounds like it was just once a week, but they didn't come away with hardly anything. Mm-hmm. If you had to go back and you only had 6 months to study before you went to China, how would you do things differently now?
I think that part I wouldn't do differently. I think I actually did that part okay. It's just that, you know, 6 months isn't going to prepare you that much for going to, you know, if you're maybe studying full time, maybe you have different options. But I think that part of thing I wouldn't necessarily change. The thing that I was really happy with about that time is I focused on pronunciation. So while I was there, I spent a lot of time just trying to figure out the tones and be able to hear the tones and differentiate the tones. And it gave me a good grounding such that when I was in China and when I was trying to speak Chinese, at least people were able to sort of understand what I was saying if I was saying a clear sentence. You know, there was a couple of other teachers in the school where I was, and one of them didn't have that same background. So, oh, you know, tones don't matter, pronunciation, not that important. A lot of the Chinese people, they would understand him, but they would also make fun of him in a way that he was speaking his own version of Chinese, his own Chinese dialect.
Oh, come listen to how cute he sounds type of a thing, right?
Yeah, that sort of thing. It's like, oh, he's speaking his own sub-dialect of Chinese.
Gotcha. Okay, well, that's very helpful, because what I'm gathering from you is that based on the time that you put in and the time that you had available to learn Chinese at that point, you were overall happy with the outcome.
Yeah, I think for the first 6 months, definitely happy with the outcome. And so I was then teaching 3 days a week, and then I had 4 days a week free to do what I wanted. And I spent that time then studying Chinese. And after that year, I then went to Beijing for a year to study at Beijing University.
And what was that experience like at the university? Because I hear a lot of different stories about university programs, but tell me, what was yours like?
I think what I would do differently, I would tell myself, you know, don't hurry. Don't be in a rush to reach advanced. You go in and you have a test. Based on your test, I'll split you into different levels. At each point, I was able to convince them to put me maybe a higher level than really, I guess, my level warranted. But, you know, you would go in and you'd have tests, and I could convince them speaking that, you know, I should maybe be in a higher level than I should have been based on the reading and writing. And I think there's also a sort of sense that people have when learning Chinese to want to be advanced, to want to be, you know, I'm in the advanced class, or I'm reading, you know, advanced text, and I'm reading, you know, advanced level material. To maybe it's, I don't know, an ego thing. It partly was maybe for me at the time. And I think that's the thing I would caution people against. It's like, you know, don't rush. I feel in some ways I skipped out on a bunch of intermediate stuff that would have helped me if I'd actually, instead of trying to rush ahead to get to some arbitrary classification of advanced, I would have been better off to just take my time and solidify more of my knowledge at the intermediate level.
That makes perfect sense to me. This kind of underscores something that we talk about all the time on this podcast. It's about, you know, comprehensible input, right? And so it sounds like you're jumping in, you were eager to jump into a higher level, but you didn't have the input that was maybe comprehensible to you. And so maybe it overall maybe hindered your progress.
Yeah. And, you know, I could definitely make do at that level, and I could keep up, and I could do the study and the review work beforehand to make sure I could, you know, do well at that level. But it just meant that there was a whole bunch of stuff at the lower level that I hadn't really consolidated, and I couldn't really use that well. And so I sort of found myself in a position which I sort of call advanced with gaps.
Ah, okay.
You know, if you're serious about Chinese, it's something that's going to take you years and years to really do. You know, you can study for decades and there'll always be something more to learn. You know, you could pass HSK level 6 and you might still have difficulty reading novels. You might still have difficulty listening to and following along to TV and radio, or participating in conversations with groups of native speakers. Advanced is really, in many cases, is just an arbitrary classification.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people rush to get to that point when they could have just slowed down and maybe consolidated actual skills.
This reminds me of something that a teacher had once told me about how he worked with his students. And this was an American guy, not a native Chinese guy. But he said that he'd take his students through these series of tests. They go through lessons and they do well in the tests and go to the next level. But sometimes the students felt like they weren't progressing and they weren't actually getting better, even though they're passing the test. And I think that's maybe sometimes we're talking mm-hmm. a little about the balance between knowledge versus proficiency. You know, it's like maybe you know some stuff, maybe there's some gaps, yeah. But actually the ability to use it. You know, that's really ultimately the end goal, is right, how you're able to use it to communicate as a tool.
Yeah.
So you went through this university program. So what did you do next?
After that, I left China for a while. back to Europe in Finland, working in software development, doing that for a year or so. This was then at the point where I was like, well, what do I want to do with my Chinese? So at that point, I was probably intermediate level, maybe. It's the point where it's like, well, you know, do I want to continue learning and actually get my Chinese to a usable point where it's actually something I can use in life, or do I just leave it where it is? You know, after some thought, I was like, well, actually, you know, I don't want to just leave it halfway. And it's like, well, okay, the only path then is forward. You know, I decided as well I wanted to improve my Chinese and I'd return to China. I still had contacts at the school where I first taught. I contacted them and say, look, you know, would you be interested in having me back? And they're like, yes. And I was like, okay, well, I'll come back, but only on the condition, again, that all of my classes are on consecutive days and then I've got the rest of the time free. They agreed to that. So then once again, I had 3 days of teaching English and then 4 days that I then put into learning Chinese and also practicing Tai Chi.
Well, something I want to know is, what was your motivation to make that decision? I mean, it sounds like, yeah, you said, oh, I could keep doing this or not, but what ultimately tipped the scales in favor of continuing to learn Chinese and deciding even to go back to China?
You know, ever since a young age, I'd always wanted to learn a foreign language. Then when I was out of China, I was then thinking, okay, well, is Chinese something I want to invest further in? And, you know, it was, you know, people talk about sunk cost fallacies. Oh, I spent so much time doing it and should I keep going? And I thought, well, you know, yes, I've invested that much time in it. It would be a shame to waste all that effort. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll go and I'll make a proper go of it to improve my level. And actually, that was the time as well when I first found out about Sinospliss and John Pazner. So he just started blogging at that time. I think it was 2003. There was like 4 or 5 blogs that were regularly sort of reporting on things of China. And so I'd be living vicariously through them. It's like working software of the day. And then I'd come back and I'd be checking up about people doing things in China. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, that's still something which interested me and that I liked. And that was actually then ties back to Chinese forums, because at the time, a bunch of different people were all creating their own sites and all talking about their experience in learning Chinese. And I was like, ah, I don't want to create a website and I don't want to have to be maintaining it myself and updating myself and blogging it myself and so on. So then that was when I came across Chinese forums and I was like, oh, okay, this is much better than setting up my own site. I can just take part in this community and I can answer questions and write my own experiences there without needing to actually set up my own site.
That's your digital home.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you about any breakthrough moments you had along the way of learning Chinese, because you kind of went through your story there, but was there any time or moment where you can really remember where it's like, wow, yeah, you had like that moment where sometimes you just connected or the language just started making sense to you or something like that?
I think there was, and this was again back when, after I'd left China the first time and reading these, one moment I remember, it was actually one of John's students, I think her name was like Laylop or something, was the site that she had, and she had like a site in English and in Chinese, and you know, I would look at the Chinese one and one day I was like, oh, actually, you know, I can read this, and it was like, you know, the feeling is like, wow, you know, I'm reading Chinese, and you know, it's not really without the aid of a dictionary, and I could sort of maybe not understand everything, but I could be looking at the Chinese and reading it and making sense of it. And that was like the first real sense of accomplishment in terms of being able to read Chinese. So that was one breakthrough for me, because it was like, you know, I could read a blog, but then if I looked at a novel and tried to read a novel, then it would just be forget about it. I had actually Chinese friends the first time I was in China. They bought me the Lord of the Rings in Chinese.
Oh, no.
And, you know, multiple times I tried to go through it. And at that point, my level just wasn't anywhere near close to being able to read that. Even though there's, you know, one of my favorite stories in the English language, and I knew the story and I was familiar with it, but trying to read that in Chinese at that point was just, it was a brick wall, basically.
You know, that touches on to something that a theory at least I have about learning Chinese, that for Chinese, comprehensible input is just a degree more important than another language for like learning Spanish. Because if you have a Spanish or a German word, you could at least sound that out. But Chinese, you just can't, yeah. Right?
Well, this is the thing. This is why the friends had bought me like the Lord of the Rings, because I'd actually spent some time in Spain when I was traveling around Europe, and my sister was living there at the time, and her husband is Spanish, and I was staying with them, and he had The Hobbit, in Spanish. And again, The Hobbit was also one of my favorite books. And so I was like, oh, great, I'll pick up The Hobbit. And, you know, I've been in Spain for, I don't know, however long, a couple of weeks, if that, you know, taking The Hobbit and reading through that and taking the Spanish-English dictionary and picking up things. And I could sort of read it and follow along and sort of guess and know where the story was going based on my own knowledge of the story. And I could sort of follow that and really work with that in Spanish. And then when I tried to do the same thing with Lord of the Rings in Chinese, it was just a completely different ballgame. You just couldn't do it.
Yeah, no way.
So I think that gets back to, again, the thing about comprehensible input. It's with Chinese, it just really is significantly different, because if you don't have enough comprehensible input, it just becomes a brick wall.
It becomes incomprehensible.
Yeah, exactly. And incomprehensible input is useless. So, and your brain just will switch off.
You know, that's the first time I've actually heard anyone put it that way. We have comprehensible input, but you also have incomprehensible input. And that can be largely useless if you don't have any comprehensible input to go with it.
And this gets back to the thing about don't rush. You know, don't rush into learning Chinese. You see and hear of people trying to read things well beyond their level. And I know that that feeling, because I've been there trying to read things well beyond my level, not just with Lord of the Rings, at various other stages. Especially nowadays, you've got a lot of pop-up dictionaries and a lot of mouse-over things that just sort of can aid you in understanding a text. Back in the day, those things didn't really exist when I was learning Chinese. But when you start using those things, that you're really selling yourself short, because you've got this thing which is well above your level and you shouldn't really be reading it. But with the aid of this technology, you can read it, but you're not actually reading it. If there are too many new words, too much incomprehensible input, what you are going to be doing is you're just going to be reading a bad English translation, because, you know, if 5 words out of 10 you don't know, you're going to be mouse overing number 1 and you're going to read that in English, and mouse over number 2 and it's going to be in English, and mouse over number 3 and it's going to be in English. And so it's like you're reading this thing which is half Chinese and then English, but using Chinese grammar and maybe the wrong word because the dictionary popped up the most common occurrence and it's actually the other occurrence that is relevant to the thing that you should be going. And so, you know, people go, oh, look, you know, I'm reading this novel, and it turns out that, well, you're not really reading it in Chinese. Because, you know, I found when I've done similar sort of things, one thing I used to do, for example, was, you know, I'd be reading Chinese and I would write the pinyin above the character that I had problems with. And, you know, you'd go on, you'd read another one, okay, and I'd write the pinyin above it to help. But then you'd go back and you would read it, and I would find that, you know, I'd be reading the Chinese, all the Chinese that I know, and then I get to the one I didn't know. And instead of looking at the character that I didn't know, my eyes would flick up, they would read the pinyin that I had written there, or, you know, the English translation, and then follow on to the next word, skipping over the word which, you know, I should have been paying the most amount of attention on. So it's like all of these things that you're looking up, they're the words that you should be spending the most attention on. But if you have things like the pop-up aids, or if you have things where you've, you know, you're writing little notes above it, what happens is you end up ignoring the Chinese word to read your English and then going on. And so, you know, it can help with short-term understanding, but it then has a negative effect on your long-term learning goals, in that all of the words you should be paying attention to, you're ignoring them.
Absolutely. You know, I wrote an article about this. It was last year. It was titled Pinyin Over Chinese, The Crippling Crutch. And,
yeah,
you know, it just kind of scores a bit what you're talking there.
And so I make a software product called Chinese Text Analyzer. One of the things with that is that the goal is to help people be able to read without the use of aids. And so what Chinese Text Analyzer does is it keeps track of your known vocabulary, and you can load up a text and it will tell you, you know, how much you know of the text and how much you don't know of the text. And so what happens, though, is if you look up a word in the dictionary, it automatically marks that word as a word you don't know. And you can't change that until you close out the program and load it up again. With the idea being that you can then generate word lists of words that you don't know for studying. And that's actually one of the controversial features of it. People are like, oh, you know, how come you won't let me mark it as known? And it's like, well, because you don't know it. You know, if you looked it up in the dictionary, if you needed to look it up in the dictionary, that's proof positive that you don't know it enough. You know, maybe you think you know it, but you don't know it well enough not to have to look it up into the dictionary. And so that the part of the goal of the program is to
to get you to focus on these words that you don't know and that you need to spend more time looking at.
So Imran, you've been involved with ChineseForums.com for a long time. You've seen a lot of learners on there ask a lot of questions. Maybe aside from some of the things you've talked about, what do you think is one of the most common mistakes or misconceptions people have about learning Chinese?
I think one of the biggest mistakes people make is that they try to learn everything all at once. They're starting to learn Chinese. They do an initial analysis and they say, right, in order to be able to read, you know, I need to know 3,000 characters, or I need to know how many words at a certain point. And they calculate that and they say, right, if I need to learn, you know, 3,000 characters, you know, I want to learn it in 6 months. If I learn, you know, X characters per day, that means I can do it in 6 months. And then they say, oh, but, you know, maybe I can double that and learn twice as many characters a day, and then I'll have it all in 3 months. And I think one of the things, people learn characters instead of words. That's, I think, one of the biggest mistakes that a Chinese learner can make. You know, people think, oh, the Chinese language is made up of characters. And, you know, technically, of course it is, but the language itself is made up of words. If you're focusing on characters and not words, you'll find yourself in the situation where maybe you can read every single character, but because you don't know where those word boundaries are and how to read the words, you might not actually understand the sentence. You should be learning words, and then as you learn words, you learn the characters in the words, rather than, you know, focusing on characters and then trying to put them together as words later. That's definitely the big one. Focusing on words rather than characters is something people need to do. And then the other thing is, it comes back to not rushing. It's, you know, you might think, oh, you know, I can learn 50 words a day. That means I can learn, you know, 1,500 words a month. After 3 months, that's like nearly 5,000 words. And I'll be able to read and speak and do things. And it doesn't really work like that. People try to use words per day as a multiplier, or characters per day as a multiplier, to get the faster level, when actually they should be thinking of smaller words per day and then making the multiplier time, or, you know, days in a row continually doing it. Because, like I said, learning Chinese is going to be measured in years. If you sit down and you look at it, you can take a very, very slow 5 words a day rate. And over the course of 3 years, you know, that's going to add up to quite a lot. Or 5 or 10 words a day is a very, very manageable level. Something you can do quite easily without risk of burnout, and something you can maintain every single day. And it's days in a row continually spent studying that are going to have a stronger effect on your Chinese over time than the number of words you learn in a given day. So I think, you know, people trying to learn large amounts of words in a day, you know, yes, you can probably do it for a short period of time. You also have to look at then the quality of the learning that you're doing. You know, maybe you're learning 50 words a day, but can you actually read those words in a sentence? You know, how do you define and measure learnt? You know, a lot of people do it as, oh, I do my flashcard reviews and, you know, I get them all right. You know, my software tells me I know 95% of the words or 90% of the words, and so that's good, I'm making progress. But, you know, what you don't realize is that with the flashcard software, often it's so removed from context, you might actually not be learning words to the degree where you need in order to be able to use them in real life. So one thing I like to say is that if you're talking about reading as a goal, you want to be able to read. In order to be able to read comfortably, you know, you need instant recognition of a word. There's no point. If you look at a word and have to think about it for, you know, even a fraction of a second, you know, half a second or a second you spent thinking about that word, that's already too slow for reading. It will completely destroy your reading process if you know, you get to a word, you stop for a second to think about it and remember, and then 5 words later, oh, stop for a second and then continue on, stop for a second. You know, that stop, start, stop, start, stop, start is actually really mentally taxing if you are trying to read anything.
You know, this is one of the reasons why I'm always out here talking about the importance of reading speed.
Yes.
You know, reading speed is a huge indicator of progress and of fluency.
Yep. And well, that's one thing. And personally, I found the biggest thing that affects reading speed is whether or not you know a word. It's like, you know, you can be going along, you hit a word you don't know. It's like you come to a screeching halt while your brain starts to figure out what it is. And maybe that screeching halt's only for like half a second or a second. And you think, oh, no big deal. And it is no big deal if you're only reading 3 or 4 sentences or a paragraph. But if you're trying to read a page in a novel or you're trying to read several pages in a novel, if every now and then you're just going stop, start, read, stop, start, read, stop, start, you'll become mentally fatigued really, really quickly, and you just won't be able to go on after, 15, 20 minutes. It's just a real struggle to keep going. And this is why I'm such a, even though I never used them because they weren't really around, I'm a big fan of the concept of graded readers, because it's like, you can choose material suited to your level, and you can be practicing all the soft skills of reading. People think about reading and they think, oh, I need to have this super large vocabulary. And that's obviously part of it, but there are a whole bunch of other soft skills which you need for reading. You've got to be parsing the word boundaries, and you've got to be identifying where they are and pulling context in from something that was mentioned a few sentences previously, and building up the story and this concept in your mind, and doing all of that at a speed which is conducive to obviously reading without all this stopping and starting. If you've got something which is slightly easier to read, or something at your level, you can be reading along and you can be building up these soft skills in reading. Once you have a core bulk of the vocabulary, it's those soft skills which are far more important in order to be able to read things than a larger vocabulary. If you have a 10,000 word vocabulary, you could spend time, learning another 5,000 words, but what that gives you in terms of increased reading comprehension is just maybe a tiny fraction of extra things you can read. You might have a 10,000 word vocabulary. You might try reading something and think, oh, it's just too difficult. I need to improve my vocabulary. What happens is you then spend time learning more vocabulary, and you come back to similar or the same text and you still have problems. That's because its vocabulary wasn't the real issue. The real issue is that you're missing these soft reading skills. And so I think if you're not focused on building up those reading skills, you will never be in a point where you can read fluently. And if you focus too much on vocabulary acquisition rather than actually doing the thing that you're trying to learn, then you'll find yourself in trouble.
Words from a man who knows.
Here's the other thing I'd say to people is that recently, there's been an over-reliance on software and algorithms to do things and to take care of all the learning for you. And I think that's a mistake people don't really realize that they're making. They're spending all this time reviewing flashcards without thinking that's like, well, actually, it's just spinning wheels because I'm learning all of these words, but I'm not learning them to the point where it's going to be helpful for reading. Because, like I said, if you're pausing for a second before you recognize, before you get the answer in your flashcard, that's going to be a fail for reading. Just got to be continually checking your learning methods and make sure that they're helping you, getting you to your goal. So, if your goal is reading, you need to be spending a lot of time doing actual reading to see where your problems are. It's only through reading that you'll find where your problems are, and then you'll be able to try to fix it if reading is your goal. If you're interested in watching TV, and then you should be watching TV and finding, okay, where's your problem? What is it that you can't address? And so continually evaluating your own learning methods and trying to build and improve upon them is a good way forward, I think.
Now, Imran, let us know again, where can people find the Chinese Text Analyzer, and tell us again about the Chinese forums, where they can find that?
Okay, so they can find the Chinese Text Analyzer at ChineseTextAnalyzer.com, or I have a website as well with other software that's on ImralSoftware.com. I also make a Chinese character worksheet generator, and then also a tool for typing pinyin with tone marks. And so all of that can be found on ImralSoftware.com. And then Chinese Forums is Chinese-forums.com. It's a great place for discussing learning the Chinese language or aspects of living in China, studying in China, different aspects of Chinese culture. There's a whole bunch of very knowledgeable people there. If you have a question about Chinese or the language or culture, that's a good place to go and ask.
And we'll include those links in the show notes. So if anyone wants to find those, you can check it out in the show notes. Well, Imran, I really appreciate you being on our show. This has been very enlightening. And thank you for sharing your perspective with us.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, mechanics, social worker, homemaker, realtor, and that one guy named Carl. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please, write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mandarincompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time.
The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself. Yep, just me, Jared Turner. I'd like to thank Imran Alston and my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pastin. See you next time.